Hi, and welcome to another World's End Toddcast. Right now we're sitting in David's home studio, which is in Long Beach, which he's got some like great, cool old synthesizers in the corner, which we were talking about before.
Yeah, most of them are still in the garage, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You got to move them in here and everything.
I don't have enough real estate anymore.
You don't want to show off all the retro gear?
No.
Plugins.
Plugins. So, you know, just to get started, you know, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York. Just outside of New York.
My father was a musician, so I've kind of been doing music my whole life. Started when I was 5.
So you basically kind of grew up hearing music all over the house and stuff like that?
Yep.
What did your dad do with music?
He was a conductor and a composer, and he did a little bit of advertising stuff, but ultimately he got out of
the music business and did like arts administration, but originally he was a musician, like Juilliard School and all that.
What would you kind of say was your like first musical memory? Like the first time you kind of realized, you know, that music was around or this thing in your
life?
That
was always around. I was put underneath his piano in the baby.
In the bassinet?
Yeah, underneath the piano while he practiced all day long. Mm-hmm. So I actually even can remember lying under the piano. I mean, it's like weird. It's always been around.
When did your parents finally like shove a musical instrument in your hands?
Five. Violin.
Oh, it was five. They were making a 5-year-old play violin.
Yeah, it was at 5. It was pick an instrument, and I said drums, and they said that's not an instrument, piano or violin. So I picked violin stupidly, and did that for my whole youth.
So from what, like, you know, age 5 until
about 13.
Until 13.
And then I actually switched over to piano and composition.
Did you like the violin? I mean, I don't think I knew any like 6-year-old violin players like when I was hanging out in kindergarten.
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was always like, I always actually listened to pop music as a kid. So there was this kind of like, I played violin and classical music, but that's not really kind of what I listened to.
Mm-hmm. So I listened to Beatles records when I was a kid. That's really what it
is. As a kid, that was kind of the big music that you're listening to, the Beatles and other kind of British bands, or was it just mostly like the Beatles were kind of the gateway into popular stuff?
Well, really early on, yeah, it was like the Beatles, and I mean, that's really young, but I'm more talking like second grade.
Yeah.
Beatles, the Monkees, you know, that's, you know, I was a kid.
Yeah.
But then by high school, I was into super esoterica, like the more, the weirder, the better. I had to find like the Italian prog rock band that no one had ever heard of that was like, you know, it was just insane, the kind of stuff I listened to.
I assume finding that stuff too must have been like incredibly hard, because like nowadays you hear of some like crazy Italian prog rock band, you Google it and you like download it or something.
Yeah, that's true.
But back then, did you have like
a record
store to go to? Or
There was a couple of record stores that were like import record stores, and there was this amazing company called Gem Records, J-E-M, which were like this European record importer, and they like basically imported everything, and so you'd look through their catalog, and that brings back memories.
And what about, so you said you know, starting with 13 you started playing piano, right?
Yeah.
Were you ever like playing a band and stuff like that when you were
when
you're in high school? No.
No.
So you were just only playing in what, school orchestra, or was it just kind of?
Yeah, orchestra. I mean, I got into piano mainly because I wanted to compose, and I thought at that point I wanted to be
like a legit composer.
You wanted to be like a classical music composer.
Kind of,
right?
Yeah. So that's kind of what I was studying, and I went to like Manhattan School of Music Prep, and I was doing like composition classes.
Mm-hmm. And so did you, when you graduated high school and you went to college, did you go in to be like a music composition major and that sort of thing?
I went to a liberal arts school, but I did study music there, and I was actually making, by my second year in college, I think I was making records, or I was already doing Scritti records by then, and getting credit
What liberal arts college did you go to?
Sarah Lawrence.
Sarah Lawrence, all right. Because I went to a liberal arts college, too. I went to Vassar, so...
Oh, Seven Sisters School.
Yeah, exactly. So we both know how you learn a whole bunch about stuff, but really don't walk away with anything important. How did you then, because I guess what, Scritti Politti was the band you were in, was kind of like your first big break, and that kind of happened?
Yeah, it was a weird, I mean, I always say this, that the business was so radically different in this was early 80s,
mm-hmm.
and this was sort of post-punk, so the labels were kind of scrambling around, not knowing what the hell was going on, mm-hmm. because all of a sudden stuff was coming out independently, and they had no control over it, and they were kind of scrambling to figure out a way to control this stuff.
And also probably lots of weird stuff coming out independently was selling tons of records, right? That they
never yeah, well, I don't, yeah, I mean, I don't know about selling tons of records, but it was enough to make people, make the majors worry about it.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden there were like all these indies, and it was just a really great time. And it was also like I could still literally, here's how it started. A friend of mine was on Z Records, which was a small label in New York that had like Kid Creole and the Coconuts and the Waitresses and all this like really cool stuff, and it was distributed by Island. And in those days, I could actually cold call the guy who ran that label,
mm-hmm.
get him on the phone, and say, you know, I was friends with so-and-so, would he listen to something I had?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, I'm kind of busy, but...
And I think he was tickled that I was calling from my dorm. So he was like, well, call me, and if I got some time, you can drive down here and play it to me.
And, you know, I just called him a few times. He was like, all right, come down.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like, ran in my car and drove down to his office and played him some stuff. And he was like, yeah, this is pretty good. Here's some money. Go do something else.
When did you decide that you wanted to make that shift from, like, classical composition? Because I assume what you were playing for this guy was more...
It was a complete lark.
Really?
Yeah, it was something I did... which was a cover version of Sugar Sugar, like kind of an electronic...
Yeah, electronic version of Sugar Sugar, and it was mm-hmm. a complete lark that I did on my father's ARP 2600.
Uh-huh.
But it kind of came out good, and I thought, I wouldn't mind putting this out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and saw him, and he was like...
Actually, he then introduced me to Jeff Travis, who was the head of Rough Trade, who happened to be... It was just one of those, he happened to be there...
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Travis heard this Sugar Sugar and was like, oh, let me put it out. And then it came out on Rough Trade. And
uh-huh.
that's how I met Green Gardsite, who was in Scritti Politti, and they were also on Rough Trade. And I mean, you know, the luck of it that Rough Trade was probably the biggest independent in England at the time.
Yeah.
Complete luck.
So you just kind of lucked into meeting the guys from Scritti Politti, basically, and then you started writing with them? Is that kind of how it happened? Or
it was a bit of a mutual admiration. It was one guy, really,
mm-hmm.
and he liked something I had put out on an NME
cassette sampler, which mm-hmm. was the thing I did for Z.
Mm-hmm. Came out on, like, an NME cassette sampler, and Scritti was on the same thing. Anyway, and we both liked each other's thing, and we ended up doing something together.
So let's play one of the songs that you did with Scritti Politti. This is called Perfect Way, which you wrote and produced, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
So how many albums did you do with the band?
We did that Cupid and Psyche 85, which was probably over the course of 2 or 3 years making that record, because it was just went on forever.
And then we made another record, which also took forever. And by that point...
So basically two albums, long story short. And by that point, we hated each other's guts and didn't talk to each other for 10 years.
Oh, God. What do you think, though, like, you kind of brought to the band as a writer and stuff and as a producer?
Well, quite a bit, because before then, it was pretty much a guitar, drums, bass
kind of band, and I basically brought the whole synth, the whole sound that most Americans know as Gritty Politti had a very large, it had a lot to do with me.
Would you say also that you were like, that for a while you've been, I guess, kind of fascinated with synthesizers? Because you said, you know, that you had made that electronic kind of sugar, and then...
Oh, yeah. I was always fascinated with synthesizers. And, you know, generally, as a teen...
Guitar stuff didn't really interest me at all. I was never really interested in that kind of, like, rock setup. So, yeah, since I was really...
Did you like it, too? Because it was, like... Because synthesizers were probably, you know, relatively new at that time, or certainly in terms of, like, more and more people buying them and
yeah, I mean, they were really coming into their own as a reality check. Like, Cupid and Psyche, when we started that album, there was no MIDI. So that just puts it into historical perspective. About halfway through making that record, MIDI came out, and we were just, you know, blew our minds that you could play one keyboard from across the room, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, just so I think since we're coming into their own, so I think it was inevitable that
people were going to get interested in making music with synths. But, yeah, it wasn't as... there wasn't as much music going, the synth-based music, as there was guitar-based music at the time, that's for sure.
So I assume it made, you know, made everyone's life easier, kind of, you know, doing...
Easier?
Yeah, I mean,
no.
The MIDI stuff and everything. No? I mean, everything more complicated?
Definitely.
So, you know, after the Gritty Politti stuff, it seemed like you kind of started working your way into the like, R&B world, right?
Yeah. After that, I kind of, like, I wanted to kind of prove myself, and I just, R&B was always my love.
And I kind of wanted to do something that was a little less pop and a little more R&B. You know, I always wonder whether that was a great decision, but anyway, that's kind of what interested me at the time, anyway.
So, what was the kind of first R&B artist that you worked with? You know, how did you transition? Because it's sort of a big transition to go from, like, pop synth to the R&B world.
Well, I think Scritti kind of had some of those influences at the time. I mean, R&B, there was kind of something going on in R&B at the time where there was a lot of synthy pop stuff being used in R&B.
Yeah.
So, like, even some of the Scritti records even charted on the R&B charts. So, it wasn't that different a thing.
And I think... Really, when I made R&B records, generally, they always fell in the cracks. They were always too pop for R&B and a little too R&B for pop. So,
but you got to work with, I mean, you know, looking at your discography, you worked with people like Chaka Khan and Luther Vandross and you know, like Sheila E. and everything. Like,
yeah. What Roger was it, too. That was a really great experience.
What was it like? I mean, what was it like working with some of those people who I assume at that point all kind of had successful careers a little bit, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Luther was still kind of in his prime. And that was...
That was a co-write. I didn't really produce that, so we just co-wrote a couple of tunes. The Roger Troutman thing was really fun. I would say he was already kind of past his super prime, although he kind of had a resurgence again
afterwards, so I caught him kind of in a bit of a lull. But it was really a great experience to work with him, because I had just been such an unbelievable fan of the Zap records, and just to see him work was just, that guy was just such a genius.
Do you think you learned a lot, or maybe not a lot?
I learned an amazing amount
from him. From both from him and also like even, you know, co-writing with someone like Luther Vandross, and just like, you know, maybe not learning. Maybe
to be
like,
frank, the Luther Vandross thing, I gave him a track and he wrote a top line. So, no.
So you didn't pick up that much from him.
No.
But you learned a lot from
yeah, Roger, we really worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot from him. Mm-hmm. A lot from him.
Now, I know also like one artist that you've worked with quite a bit is, now I hope I pronounced it right, but Michelle Ngocello?
Ndege Ocello.
Ndege Ocello, okay.
Yeah.
I'm just going to call her Michelle from here on out.
Fine.
Because it's probably going to be a lot easier. But how did you and her kind of, you know, get together in the first place? Because you went on to produce like, you know.
Yeah, I did a lot of her stuff.
A few of her albums.
First few records.
I was a staff producer at Warner Brothers Records in the early 90s, and she was signed, even though she was on Maverick, I think it was Peter Edge who was an A&R guy at Warner Brothers, really found her and brought her in, and I went to her showcase and met her, and then she just called me after that, and we worked on a couple things, and we just worked really well together, and it went from there.
Well, let's play one of the songs that you produced for her. This is a song called Outside Your Door, which was produced by David.
Yeah.
Michelle got along so well together, you know, enough to do a, you know, a few albums together.
She was a kind of an old soul,
mm-hmm.
and I was at that time really into
the soul records of the 70s and recreating that sound, and
mm-hmm.
we were just really on the same page artistically and sonically and what we were trying to do, and it was like I was really trying to limit the sonic palette at that point after all the synths. So mm-hmm. we used a really limited bunch of instruments on her record. It was just like, it was sort of drum machines and then Rhodes, clavinet, mini Moog.
Was that a fun kind of change of pace for you too, to go from, you know, stuff that's more synth driven to something that's more, you know, organic and everything?
Yeah, it was. Working with her was really enjoyable too, because it also. I could just kind of get into her head. I wasn't writing on the stuff, and it was kind of like really, really more the producer head in terms of,
let me get into her head and to see what she's trying to do, and kind of subverting your own
mm-hmm.
aesthetic in some ways. So it was fun. I really enjoy working with her.
Cool. And it definitely, you know, the collaboration must have paid off, because you know, that kind of helped make her career, probably. Those
yeah, we got those. Both of those records are Grammy nominated.
And now you're someone that definitely, you know, you produce and you write. Is there one that you prefer, or do they both kind of, you know, do work different parts of your brain?
They do work different parts of your brain. Right now,
mm-hmm.
just I'm sort of enjoying the writing thing but I go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends.
And now I know, you know, right now you've been developing like this new artist, Casey Brown.
Signed to Interscope. She had a record out already a couple mm-hmm. years ago. This is her second album.
But now you're working with her on tracks for her new record.
Right.
And what kind of direction do you think you guys are trying to take with her, with the sound? Is that too general a question?
You know, it's the pop record, mm-hmm. but, you know, I want to do something interesting and
mm-hmm.
make it sound unique. And she has a really kind of a cool vibe vocally.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know, you want to write and produce something that feels right on her mm-hmm. and just doesn't feel like generic. So mm-hmm. hopefully we achieve that and still have it sound like pop.
Mm-hmm.
So
what other kind of stuff have you been working on? Have you just been doing kind of a lot of writing for yourself and stuff, or have you been working with some other artists?
No, trying to write with artists. We wrote a song with this girl, Ricky Lee from Australia, that just came out, and there's a few different artists we're writing with now.
Mm-hmm.
So I much prefer writing
mm-hmm.
with the artist rather than just writing in a room for somebody. I would rather tailor make the song for somebody.
When you write with an artist, do you definitely feel like you're kind of collaborating with them and you know, working with them to make something right, you know?
Definitely. Yeah. And I really respond to, like,
just having somebody in the room and seeing the kinds of things they like
or respond to really directs how the writing goes.
It's probably great because you can feed off their energy and they
very
feed
much
off your
so.
Energy yep. and excitement and you kind of like
build like this Ricky together. Lee song. I would have never
written that song because it's not necessarily
totally my aesthetic, but I can get into her
mm-hmm.
what she likes about it
mm-hmm.
and I think it works well for her and mm-hmm. I can totally see that it works well for her, but if she hadn't been in the room,
would have never written that song.
Yeah.
So
well, David, I want to thank you for sitting down and talking to me, and you can look forward to more World's End podcasts in the future. Thanks.
Thank you.